So please help me welcome JC streaming in from Boca Raton, Florida.
Thank you, Kelly. And if you could be so kind as to help me with any questions, just barge in. Hey, JC, we have a question and let it rip, because I'm going to go through about a 30-40 minute little presentation where we are chatting like this with nothing in the background, and then I'm going to be moving this thing. Now, when I move and I get away from the computer, the audio may, you know, get a little echoey and stuff like that, especially when I do that, if I need to turn around. And I'll be try to be very conscious of that and speak louder or ask if anybody lost what I said or anything like that. So please feel free to tell Kelly, hey, what did he say? I missed what he said, so we can, so nobody falls behind. We can all be on the same page. Cool? All right, now I am going to share my screen and we're gonna do a little presentation, and then we'll come back to the live room and we'll rock from there. All right, here we go. So Kelly, this looks good on screen right here?
Now it looks great.
Perfect, all right. So we're here to talk about a very, very hot topic. And man, it's been hot for so long. I think it's been hot since I got into this, for 30, 40 years. And like all trends, it's gone this way and that way. And then you have research chime in, and sometimes the research comes up with something. But if you look at the research protocols, you go, they came up with this result, but it's not the protocol that I use, or the protocol that anybody uses that I know. And that's the problem sometimes with science. So when people say, follow the science, which is a very, very popular phrase these days, I always say, be careful, because you have to understand the scientific method when you try to follow the science. The science doesn't discover anything. It merely tries to explain what we have been seeing for many years. So if you want to be ahead, you can't follow the science, because the science is always behind us trying to explain and move things forward. But the people at the spearhead are the pioneers. And pioneers are 98% crazy. And you never remember them for their craziness. You always remember them for that 1 or 2% of brilliance that changes humanity. So when you're moving and you're seeing pioneers in many cases yourself, because all of you are pioneers in your own way, trying new things and coming out with new things, a lot of times it's the first time that you do it. And sometimes it doesn't work and it doesn't look good. And that's fine. That's perfectly fine. That's like falling off of a bike. You need that in order to learn how to ride the bike. So everybody, don't be afraid of experimenting and saying, you know, I tried that and it wasn't sexy, it wasn't good, or you know what, it was awesome, but I can't apply it with most people because they don't have the skills, we don't have the equipment, we don't have the time, etc. All right, so flexibility and mobility is a hot topic, so we'll get into that in a little bit. Special thanks to everybody from Kelly to Connie, everybody in between, Activate, all of you guys are awesome. I can't wait to go back to Canada. I haven't been there in like almost 2 years. So when this thing goes live, I'm the first one there with Connie. If you guys want to visit IHP Pro Shop, the code IHP15FIT will give you 15% discount on all educational videos and products, okay? All right, next thing, operational definitions. Okay, when we talk about operational definitions, it's not that the definition we're providing is the end all be all, no. We are providing this definition so we can get on the same page for discussion. It doesn't mean that I own the definition, doesn't mean it's even the right definition. It's the definition we need so we can discuss the topic. So for operational purposes, okay, for discussion purpose, I will refer to flexibility as simple. Its definition, the range of motion about a joint, period, end of story. That is the definition of flexibility. We're not talking about flexibility under speed, this, that, and the other. Flexibility, the definition is range of motion about a joint. Okay, how do I differentiate that with mobility? Okay, well, the first two letters there kind of dictate why I like mobility so much. And flexibility, you have to kind of quantify it, or at least define it. Mobility implies that there's motion, there's movement involved. And when I say movement, I don't mean somebody else moving your limb. I mean the body moving its own limb, you moving your own limb. And normally, flexibility could be anything. Flexibility could be a position that you acquire and you go, look how flexible I am. Flexibility could be somebody putting you in a certain position and somebody going, wow, look how much flexibility you have gained. Okay. But flexibility for the most part does not invoke control and movement. It kind of invokes a quality or a position, right? That's just my opinion. So when we're discussing, understand that that's the point of view from where I'm coming. All right. Mobility is motion. Flexibility is more like position or a quality. Mobility gives you the description of that quality. All right. Okay. Now. All right. Where are we at here? All right. The big difference is flexibility. Normally, when you talk about it, okay, what's the flexibility of the knee? 135 degrees. But where does that come from? Well, it comes from anatomical studies, you know, university academics. They have a cadaver, they move the joints, and they go, okay, this joint moves about this percentage. And that's where we get flexibility from, when you study it in an academic anatomy environment, such as a certification book or a university. Now, mobility is more in line with the function. What range of motion do you have use of? Because you can control, because you can move, as in mobility. That's the one I'm interested in. That I'm not so much interested in flexibility, a number. I'm more interested in what you can do. Can you throw a ball? Can you throw a ball fast? All right, is your arm in the right position to throw a ball? Is your arm working with the other systems to be able to throw the ball? And when you start looking at that complexity, all of a sudden the shoulder joint flexibility is not the only thing you need to look at. And we'll show you why, when you look at mobility, you kind of have to get away from flexibility, because mobility implies multiple systems working together. Here's the crux of it. Everybody has different anatomical structures. Not all hips are created equal. Not all hips are created to do straddle splits, full squats, etc. Not all shoulders are made for downward dog. Not all shoulders are made for snatches and overhead squats. Just some of those movements will take a specific anatomical part and shred it up if it's not made for that. So mobility takes all of that into consideration. Flexibility often looks at a single joint, and therapy often looks at a single joint, a single muscle. When you need to look at this mobility, because as you guys know, the core can help the shoulder, and the core can help the elbow, and the core can help the knee and ankle. So now flexibility, mobility, strength is just not a single joint phenomena. So those are the things that we have to look at. And that's why this thing here has to be kind of defined, even if you don't agree with the definition, just so we can discuss it. All right, what's wrong with the research? And I've gone through the research here for a long, long time. The protocols. For example, you have research that will stretch a muscle for 2 minutes and 15 seconds. Well, that's not the same thing as a 30-second stretch. You have research that stretches a muscle and immediately tries to contract it. Well, that's not the same thing as stretching a muscle and then waiting 2 hours to contract it. And why would I even mention that? I'm in the combat game, okay? We didn't end up very well last night at UFC. Our champion lost the title, but anyways, it is the drama of sports, right? So I'm in the combat game and I see the fighters stretching, Canelo, Triple G, or MMA fighters. And then I see them get in the ring. But here's the kicker. The stretching is done. The flexibility is acquired about 2 hours before the first punch is thrown. If you follow them coming into the arena, and they follow this in the championship fight, when they start dressing up and when they start taping and when they start shadow boxing, when they start to warm up and when they start to stretch. Stretching is the first thing they do. And I have measured this with time clock, actually. It's really easy. By the time they finish stretching and they put on their gear and they tape up and they shadow box and they cue for the production, because that's a long walk to the ring. They sing, they introduce everybody, blah, blah, blah. And the first punch is thrown. in a professional championship fight in boxing, it's usually around the 2 hour mark. So I ask you, what did the flexibility do? What did the stretching do 2 hours later? Maybe it's not for range of motion. Maybe the flexibility is done as part of a ritual that keeps the sympathetic system down and allows that parasympathetic so you don't have the adrenaline dump. So don't think that when you see something, it's being used for what you think it's being used for. Sometimes there's something else behind it. Now, I can't tell you for certain, but I can tell you that any flexibility you get 2 hours later is gone, okay? So Mike, the whole thing is, being a former combat athlete, what did I feel when I was doing this flexibility? And you know what I felt? Calm. Why? Because what do they tell you always when you reach terminal flexibility? Breathe, breathe, relax. So maybe that flexibility is not for flexibility. Maybe that little 15, 20 minutes is not for flexibility, is for management of adrenaline. Just saying. So the research, the protocols are all different. You're looking at stretching compliance. You're looking at pain tolerance. You're looking at injury prevention. And you're looking at other considerations that are so complex that I don't think we can make a statement on whether this is best, that's. And then you'd have differences in people, from chemical differences that could impact how muscle is stretched, the pain tolerance that you have. All of that is mediated chemically. You might be wired a certain way neurologically. You have people that are wired to exert a lot of strength. You get your power lifters that are 180 pounds and deadlift 500, and you go, how is that even done? I mean, I've been in the strength game all for a long time. I'm not wired like that. And I don't consider myself a weak person, but I am not wired that way. And so there's a genetic neuromuscular component, there's a genetic chemical component, and then you have the genetic structural component that's insane. When you put all that together, discussing this from a factual standpoint and from a objective, measurable standpoint becomes almost impossible. I can tell you that right now. And most of the stuff that we have, if you look at Nikolai Bogduk and his research on back pain and back pain research, the research basically is equivocal, and we really don't know. And if you look at stretching protocols today and stretching research, you still find that gray area where they tell you more research is needed. So there's a lot of problems with the science, and there's a lot of problems with what you're trying to get done here. Okay, now the question is, what about passive range of motion, which is flexibility, versus active? Is there a difference? So in other words, if I acquire more flexibility in my hamstring when I'm at a table with a therapist, does that imply that I can decelerate a low volley in tennis, which is the job of the hamstrings, the glute, and the paraspinals, the three amigos? Okay, can the hamstrings control hip flexion? And even worse, can they control eccentric muscle action during running or during deceleration? So if that's the case, everybody with long sit and reach measurements should have reduced back and reduced hamstring strains. And that should happen as well. We should see increased performance as well. And we don't see that. We just don't see that. We don't see that correlation. All right. Here's another question. If I give the body a range of motion, just a range of motion, will the body take that range of motion as usable? In other words, if I give my hamstrings a long, long range of motion on a table, somebody puts me through PNF stretching, which is probably one of the most successful ways to gain range, and I do my thing, will that guarantee me that I have a higher kick? Will that guarantee me that I won't pull my hamstring when I'm running? And to add even crazier stuff to that, you guys know that when you pull your hamstring running, everybody says, shorten hamstrings, you need more stretching. Well, here's a little question that you can throw in there to just complicate the living dates out of it. If the hamstring range of motion, if the hamstring flexibility is a determining factor in hamstring pulls, how come the hamstring pulls occur in the middle of the range of motion at foot plant? It's not occurring at extremes. And if it's not occurring at extremes, it can't be a length issue. How many hamstrings pulls do we have in sports? It could be that and lower back are probably the most common. I would say of the locomotive sports, hamstring pulls is the most common injury. More than ACLs, more than lower back in locomotive sports, such as soccer, tennis, and so on and so forth. Track and field, running, all that. So if foot plant is where this thing happens, then how can it be a range of motion issue? It can't be. It's happening right in the middle of the range. So it has to be what? It has to be a dynamic quality. It has to be, I don't know, compliance, contraction, speed of contraction. And therein lies the issue of studying this from an academic and research standpoint. Good luck. I just don't have that many lifetimes. I mean, my job is to get somebody better. And I have 50 million questions around methodology, how you're going to study, how long is the stretch, what do you do after, what do you do before, what's the stretch for, what's the anatomical structure of the individual, what's their, you see the confounding variables where they start happening and you're like, so what are we studying? And if you're a practitioner, you got the person for half an hour, you got them for an hour, you have them 2 or 3 days a week, and they got to play soccer and they're trying to get a scholarship. You don't have time for this methodology to become clear when there's so many questions. So these are the issues that we have trying to study. So in all fairness to scientists, they have an impossible job, okay? And the main thing that you have to do is think, if I'm stretching a muscle, am I giving that muscle permission to go to a length that it can't control under the right load and the right speed? Ooh, huh, what if that happens? What if that happens? You lay down, your hamstrings, boom, over here. Hey, man, you're good to go. Kick the guy in the head. You got plenty of range of motion in those hamstrings. You know, do cheerleading. You got plenty of hamstring flexibility. And then all of a sudden, I'm going to that range under high speed, high loads, and you've never seen that in the flexibility. So then the question is, well, Carlos, why don't you do both? Why don't you stretch and then practice the activity, such as ballet classes, such as all martial arts classes. What do? You go in there, you warm up a little bit, and then you do your stretching, and then you go to your class, and then maybe you stretch a little bit after. All right, fair enough. Now, my question is, and I found this out because I was part of both arts. When you're in martial arts, you go into a dojo, and there's a very, very strict sequence of classes, right? You go in there, you bow, you get dressed, boom, you warm up, you stretch, and then you go through all your stuff, and then you stretch at the end. When you go to a boxing for full contact, which is the people from karate were coming over to boxing, that doesn't exist in boxing. In boxing, you go in there, you wrap your hands, and you start shadow boxing, and you start skipping rope, and you go. You go from little bit to heavy. There is no stretching for the most part in boxing. Very little. Certainly not in the order and in the discipline that martial arts have. These guys still kick high. These guys are still flexible. They don't lose their flexibility on high kicking and so on and so forth. So when you look at that, you go, okay, is it the stretching that made them flexible? Or is it the 300 kicks that they did after the stretching and before the stretching that made them flexible? Well, we don't know. So we go to the kickboxers in boxing gyms. They're still flexible. They're no longer stretching. So then if you're going to do a little meta-analysis or a little descriptive research, you can say, hey, these guys, once you acquire flexibility, it's yours. And if you, as long as you use it, you don't have to stretch it because you use it. That's the argument of somebody who sees that observation. Then you can get into questions. Yeah, well, the stretching in karate and ballet were the ones who gave them the flexibility to begin with. And then I'm going, no, not necessarily, because I did martial arts for years and I could never do a straddle split. Why? Because my hips won't do it. My hips won't do it. My friends had hips that were beautiful. They were just like, whoop, and they just laid there. So now I got two artificial hips. Here's the question. Why do I have artificial hips? I'm not sure. Was it that extreme range of motion from Olympic weightlifting? Was it the insisting on straddle splitting for 15 years in karate? What what tore both of my hips up? Artificial hips. What tore them up? Not sure. But I can tell you that extreme ranges of motion were probably involved. Ranges of motion that my body was not used to. So we have a structural issue that we have to take into consideration in yoga classes, in overhead squats, and in things that we really mean well by. And we're not doing people a solid a lot of times with the flexibility issue. Okay. So those are all questions that we have to add. So if you're going to study one piece of research, this is one of my favorites that I give to you from Schreer, almost 2000. And this is a literature review on stretching before exercise. Now, the reason I chose before exercise is because they go into so much cool stuff involving how muscles work and how stretching works. So whether you want to know if to use it as a warm-up or not, this is a great piece of research that you can get. Okay. And if not, I got my my email is jcs@ihpfit, jcs@ihpfit.com, jcs@ihpfit.com. I will send you this research if you contact me, and I will also send you this presentation, okay? In case you don't have it, I'm going to send it to Connie anyways, okay? So if you look at this, this is very interesting. Schreer poses five reasons why stretching could pose a problem for you. Number one, compliance. Compliance is the difference between a balloon. When you blow up a balloon, it's compliant. But a balloon doesn't store a lot of energy, and it doesn't transfer a lot of energy because it's compliant, okay? A floor, concrete, it's not compliant. But you can run faster on concrete than you can on sand that is compliant. So when you're making a muscle compliant, be careful what you're doing, because you might be able to get the muscle to absorb more, but not transfer more. Oops. So you got to be very careful if compliance is what you want and what type of compliance. Now you have also, am I lengthening the muscle? And can a lengthened muscle produce force? And we already know that a lengthened muscle cannot produce force, especially if you really lengthen it. So most of the research really has not done us a solid. Why? Because most of the research that studied stretching and function, or stretching and muscle action, stretched the living daylight out of a muscle and immediately tried to contract it. Well, you know, that's like taking a cotton shirt, really, really stretching it and see what happens. Well, it's all stretched out. It's ugly. You need to get it back in the washer and dryer, let it, you know, shrink back up before it looks normal. The muscle's kind of like that, you know? So it really didn't study stretching the way we do it. How do we do it how do you see it in sports? Stretching is this, you know, they do that and then they'll hold it for 2 seconds. They might even bounce, boom, boom. They jump, they go like this. They stretch it for 2 or 3 seconds. And that's the stretching I see. I never see 30 second stretch, much less 2 minute stretching, which is some of the studies that you see out there, okay? So they haven't even studied our type of stretching, which is more of a dynamic, a bounce. When we stretch in sports, we stretch to create function. So A, we have to show the muscle the length it's gonna work, little by little, progressively get it to work faster and faster and faster, if that's what we're going to be doing, okay? And then more importantly, get your central nervous system excited about using the muscle. PNF stretching is the opposite. The whole idea of contracting and relaxing is to try to fake the muscle. What you're trying to do is get the muscle drunk for it to give you compliance and not know what is happening. You don't need that from your muscles. You need activated muscles that are hypertonic, that are ready to go. That's not stretching, and that's not what stretching does unless it's dynamic stretching and you actually bounce it. Because when you bounce it, what are you doing? You're waking up receptors that most stretching puts to sleep. So you can see how the function of mobility and the story of stretching is really conflicting. We have to think this out better because it's not working. Hamstrings are still a big problem, and we're still stretching things. So Stu McGill even finally came out in his last years as a professor, and even still, that says you don't stretch a low back, especially if it's injured. You do not stretch an injured low back. You stabilize it first. You give it rigidity first. He's the first scientist to actually say that. What do we see in every rehab program? Every doctor, every therapist, stretch it. I got a disc, stretch it. I got a spondyl, stretch it. I got this, stretch it. It's just like ice. Put everything, put ice on it. Ice is not the end all be all, and neither is stretching, okay? So compliance, length versus force. Sometimes you need length, and sometimes you need force, and sometimes you need both. And stretching just gives you length. It doesn't necessarily give you force. Dynamic versus static compliance. Static compliance would be a pitcher doing an external rotation stretch. Dynamic compliance is that stretch at that high speed. At that high speed. There's your difference. So yes, would you do some stretching with a pitcher? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, he's got to get there under high speeds and high loads. Same thing with serving in tennis. Same thing with all gymnastics. Same thing with running, etc. Now, there is some damage that you can do to the muscle fibers when you stretch them. And we know that there's damage. And when there's damage, there is performance decrement, without a doubt. And all of this is outlined in this research, so you can really, really read on it more extensively, all right? But there is damage when you stretch. And here's the problem, which is the last one. Stretching, we know, increases the masking of pain. And as a matter of fact, most of the research now says that the characteristic changes that you get from stretching are not anything other than your pain tolerance has gone up. And now you're capable of stretching the tissue more because of pain tolerance. All right. So it's really not characteristic changes in the muscle. It's pain tolerance. So you really haven't done anything other than increase your pain tolerance to that particular stretching, which may not help your throwing, your serving, and your lower back issue. Compound that to number four, when you numb up. Did I hear somebody?
Yep, someone accidentally unmuted
themselves. Okay, cool. I just want to make sure that I wasn't hallucinating. All right. So when you mask the pain, now you go back to number four. There's more damage. Now there's more damage, there's more problems. So I'm not saying that stretching is bad. All I'm saying is that you have to think about what you're doing and that all stretching is not created equal and stretching does not fix the problems that you think it fixes. Now, all right, weak muscles. How did we get here? All right, you guys know that the body protects itself incredible. It's got receptors. It's got Golgi tendons. It's got Purcini corpuscles, it's got spindles, it's got everything. It's got receptors we haven't even discovered yet. And it's made to protect itself. So if you cannot control a range of motion, there's going to be neural inhibition and your body's not going to give you the strength and you're not going to explore that range of motion. All right, from the outside, you don't get to a range of motion, where do they go? Oh, they're tight. What's the fix? Stretch them. Wait a minute. No. They can't control a range of motion. So the answer should not be stretch. The answer should be, can I give them strength in that range of motion so they can utilize it? What if we do that? Is it possible that if they can't get to a low volley using the hips, and I'll show you that in the demonstration, if they can't get there, then do we have an exercise that can teach them how to get there and get them there quick and get them there fast and get them there faster and quicker? If the answer is yes, then stretching is not necessary. What's necessary is that strengthening mobility exercise that gives you that range that you didn't have to begin with. So is it a flexibility or is a mobility issue? Semantics. I say basically it's both because we all know what we're talking about. But in my language, it's mobility, okay? All right, so obviously static range of motion is not related to dynamic range of motion. You can be statically, you can put your head between your knees and still pull your hamstrings. You can put your head between your knees and still have lower back issues. So flexibility, static range of motion doesn't always correlate to dynamic function. The body will give you the range of motion only that it can control, and controlling is a function of strength, not a function of sarcomere or actin and myosin lengthening and stuff like that. And there should be a progression. a basic training and mobility progression. First, stabilize the joint. Before you range of motion it, stabilize it. Then increase range of motion little by little, and then bring in the appropriate speeds and loads. That is an insanely simple way to approach your training, your function, and your mobility. Okay, so now let's talk about, for the next 20, 30 minutes, let's show you a few exercises so we can show you what we're talking about. All right, so